being able to prove something at a particular point in time that Native people can say, well, they've started, let's give them, I was going to be cynical and say, let's give them some rope, but let's give them some time. The comment that I referred to and others have referred to about corporations and even in this instant moment being dynamic and able to be creative is also something that is both possible and impossible depending upon what kinds of time frames that you're talking about. And Dave Hickok's comment that we can do anything, not anything, but that we have flexibility in ANCSA to deal with some of these problems ourselves. And Mr. Jones' comment that one of the fundamental underpinnings of ANCSA was that Natives were being given the opportunity to make difficult choices is one that is a belief that is not unknown to us. And many Native corporations and institutions involved with ANCSA are making efforts to deal with that. For example, Sea Alaska Corporation submitted to its shareholders at its last annual meeting a proposition which essentially asked, should Sea Alaska begin to try to devise a method or methods by which corporate-owned lands could be taken out of the corporation and be put into some other status for the long-term benefit of Native people as Native people? And the response to that proposition from shareholders was overwhelmingly yes. And as we've begun to look at how that might be done within existing within existing statute, we've looked at things like the Bishop Trust, and we're looking at the Royal Dutch Shell, and we're looking at all sorts of options that we might pursue. And we think that you could probably cobble up something that for an individual corporation at a particular point in time might make sense. But I think that begs the question of justice. And I go back to my Tanunuk observation yesterday, that the corporations own the land, and its purpose under ANCSA is an economic one. It has nothing to do with tribalism. It has nothing to do with being native land. And we're trying to use structures that don't deal with those issues at all to create some sort of patchwork response to what is essentially a question of justice. And again, I say that while we say it with some fervor, and justice can be very broad and overwhelming in its connotations, that I think that justice can be achieved within the framework of the ANCSA legislation if we all put our minds to making those changes, that it would not do violence in any significant way to what Congress really intended for Native people and would be responsive to what Native people had intended at the time as to how land would over the long term be owned and utilized. So some corporations, and most corporations I think, are looking at these issues and are trying to be responsive to the interests and the needs of their shareholders. And of course, having said, as I have several times during my opportunity to speak at this, what do you call this thing? Hearing.
It doesn't look very round, but that's what it is.
You know, I have said it a number of times that we need changes, needs to be done with the framework of justice, that there are fundamental problems but that they can be accomplished within the framework of the existing law and our existing relationship and understanding with Congress. And so I guess to some degree I respectfully disagree with someone whom I respect very much, Frank Peterson, that ANCSA was a farce. I agree that the corporation is an institution for trickle-down economics with large benefit going over time not to shareholders but to the survival of the institution. And that's largely what corporations are all about. That's the way the law made them. And that's one of the things we have, it's been difficult for us, both from a technical viewpoint and from a viewpoint of simple justice, I think, again, to explain to shareholders. If you own 100 shares in IBM, IBM may earn $4 billion in 1983, but if you own 100 shares out of the millions that may be outstanding, that 100 shares might get you $100. In terms of a dividend. And if you don't like the way IBM is managed, you know, you don't go to the annual meeting and try to throw out the chairman and the president and the board of directors. You sell your stock and you go somewhere else where you think that your investment will make the kind of return that you expected. And it's in that alienation feature of our stock that a large part of the political problem that we face flows, but it is also, of course, that feature which gives us the opportunity to maybe deal with some of the problems that we have with ANCSA. The corporate vehicle is just really an anomaly, dichotomy. I don't even know what those words mean. I just read them someplace. It's very frustrating, and I don't know how Charlie or Frank or John or John Hope might have felt at certain times, but there are times when I just want to rip off this suit, you know? And I feel like I'm outside myself looking at this guy being involved as a corporate mogul, to use a term that people have used, because a lot of times this thing doesn't make sense to me. You know, why should I be over here trying to make this business work? For all the money we make, to the individual shareholder, it's not going to make a fundamental difference in their individual economic status unless we liquidate the corporation. And if we liquidate the corporation, utilizing all of its assets, we will have disposed of the land. But at the same time, I look at the institution and I say, minority people generally have been kept minority people in terms of their economic status and in terms of their social status, largely because they haven't had economic power. And if we can use these institutions to, as a people, gain economic power over time, to be able to influence public policy, to be able to influence social policy, to be able to influence business policy, then what an incredible opportunity that is for our people. But the individual expectations and what the corporation can really do, both in the short term and the long term, are at this point very, very divergent. And that is a big problem for us. There is an inherent conflict between village corporations and regional corporations. Witness what we're doing with gravel, but they are conflicts that are able to be dealt with, I think, by native people and the institutions themselves. They aren't of the fundamental nature that some of the other problems that we face in ANCSA may be. The comments that Mr. Paul made about AFN that it represents regional corporations, is owned by regional corporations, is certainly true, but it is also funded, and its board of directors also includes the nonprofit corporations, which have very powerful ties and involvements with particularly the village and rural areas, and the convention has no power. That ignores, of course, the whole underpinning of Native strength, as it's been demonstrated over the years, which is that of moral suasion. And I think it was clearly demonstrated just the other night in an AFN dinner meeting that was held, where a number of us were talking about AFN and where it's going with 1991. And I want to point out once again, Mr. Chairman, that there are other institutions that are as deeply involved and as concerned with and as organized and are working to deal with this issue. And at some point, I would hope that there would be a way that all of those forces could be brought together at some point to see where we are, because these processes, these efforts, should be ones of fostering unity and strength as opposed to creating divergence and acrimony. And that just relates once again to one of the things that we've understood right from the beginning and which has been demonstrated here and in some form has been used on us as a form of tyranny. That is, you have to be united. You know, if a senator says, don't come to us in Washington unless you're united, you know, he's just copped out. Because in sometimes that just ain't possible. And I suspect that in dealing with fixes to ANCSA, that it is going to become more difficult for us to create monolithic and all-encompassing single kinds of solutions, because we don't have the kind of flexibility, unless we do start over, that we had at the outset. I do agree that even if we bring options, we ought to agree on at least the menu, and if that's what is meant by being united, I have no problem with that. But to get back to the dinner meeting the other night, there was some conversation in which I was involved, saying how to begin to be more focused in 1991 and our response to the issues that exist. And when it was all said and done, the AFN leadership, the management of AFN, said, we don't want the regents to get too far out in front. We aren't particularly interested in what you folks cobble up as specific solutions. We want to go back to the convention. We want that gathering, regardless of why people come together, for friendship or whatever reasons, we want that gathering, which is a very responsive widely representative gathering, to be largely responsible for giving this institution the direction that it needs. And I think that is a commentary on how AFN functions and the kind of institution that it is that speaks for itself. we're all concerned about the possibility of takeover and 1991, and I've got some personal feelings about and ideas about how to deal with that, but I don't think that, at least at this point in your hearings, Mr. Berger, that is appropriate. But what opportunity for losing the land that 1991 makes possible is very, very frightening. And I think that that was a point that has been well made here. I would make, once again, a personal observation, Mr. Chairman, however, by saying that if the corporations were stripped down racehorse type of financial, economic, business institutions without carrying the obligation for nativeness that comes to the corporation because it owns the native's land, that at whatever time stock may become alienable, that we would have a very different capability to deal with those kinds of problems. But in a for-profit business corporation in this day and age, in this current economy, the competitive edge that is required for just survival is so great that to be encumbered with these other obligations for a business corporation creates serious problems. And I'm not saying that in any negative way, but from a business corporation viewpoint, I'm just stating what I consider to be reality. And if we find some way to get the land, that land which natives identify as having native cultural value, something that is a touchstone of their history and their existence, which may or may not be all of the land within corporations. I would hope that it would not be all of the land. I don't know that any of us lived very deeply within the earth, for example, that it would be important that the subsurface not be retained in some manageable way that does not do violence to the surface ownership for native purposes, that might not be retained in the profit-making corporations. But if we could create a mechanism to separate those two, the chance for success that, in my judgment, as we are faced with 1991, would be immeasurably increased. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Malott. Mr. Johnson?
I've been sitting here making notes, and sometimes I've wanted to go like this and say something, but it's kind of difficult when you're sitting here. Some comments, a statement made yesterday by Frank Peterson about ANCSA as a farce. We can tie that to a couple other statements that have been made. Fred Paul made a statement about the roots of ANCSA settlement, you know, lie in the fact that there was tribal rights involved and the corporations are there because of tribal rights. John Borbridge made some statements about looking back about the legalities of ANCSA settlement, which tied to statehood or tied to laws that were passed. And if we accept those statements, we must then say those are true if we assume that ANCSA was a just settlement, that it was a settlement that Uncle Sam recognized our rights. The matter of fact is Uncle Sam has never recognized the rights of indigenous people and settled them in a just manner. You can look down the history of the U.S. Not once has there been a settlement because Uncle Sam or Congress or whoever said these people have rights and we should acknowledge them and there should be justice. It has never happened. It only happens if there's an economic or other gain to be had. And I think that we have to look at the fact that ANCSA, and really what brought it, really brings it out, is Mr. Jones's statement about what the feelings and what the thoughts were of the staff in Congress and the people that were involved. It really brings down to us the fact that the ANCSA is an economic settlement. It's not a settlement or recognition of any rights that we have. Whether those are there or not, it's a poignant argument to make, but it just doesn't fly in the face of fact. So ANCSA then is really an economic settlement. So then let's look at some of the other statements that I'd like to make comments on. On the elective process, I've been involved with quite a few Indian groups in the states, reservations. And the elective process that Mr. Paul talked about in the corporations and the tendency of management or those in power to insulate themselves or to use the mechanism of the corporation to remain in power is really not a characteristic of corporations any more than it's a characteristic of municipal government. The very same arguments that Mr. Paul had stated have been used time and time again on reservations, and when they talk about their chief or the chairman of the tribal council, the very exact same arguments I've heard time and time again by the people that want to throw the bum out or whatever. The fact of the matter is, in the corporations in Alaska, at least the regional corporations, you can look at the changes that have been made in the corporation's leadership. And in fact, you have to come to the conclusion that they are dynamic corporations that are continually changing. Look at the fact that many people have been voted out of office. And the statement that perhaps the leadership in the corporation is not listening to or does not represent the feelings of the stockholders is really not there. Because if you look at the fact of the matter, it doesn't take very long for our stockholders, if the leadership or the board or whoever is not responding to what they feel is the responsibilities of the corporation, for that person to be voted out. And we have seen that time and time again. Now, to the statement about an inherent conflict between villages and regions, there's a couple of things I think that we should understand about that. One, you know, the villages are both our strength and our Achilles heel at the same time. Because, let's look at the strength side of it. And what we expected somewhat out of the Land Claims Act. The expectations, I think, are starting to coalesce that the Act really provided us a vehicle to remain unique and provided us to maintain some uniqueness as a people, that through the Act and the corporations, at least the village corporations, control over the surface of the land, it allowed us to continue to live a life, you know, free from some other pressures perhaps that might come about if we did not have ownership of this land through the corporations, that without that land base and without the villages, we would not have been able to maintain, you know, our identity or our lifestyle or our culture. At the same time, we hear about some villages with tremendous wealth. And the fact that when the stock becomes alienable, we might lose particular villages or the control of particular villages because of their wealth. And that's a very true and real danger in 1991 if we do not do something about the alienability issue. Now, I want to also add to what Byron was saying about the fact of the existence or continued existence of Indians in the South 48. And I think the statement that he made that were there no reservations, there would not be Indians as we know them now. The fact that there is a Crow reservation or Sioux reservations have allowed them to maintain that identity, maintain their language, maintain their culture. Now, if we grade the survival of people on, or if we grade an institution on how it affects the survival of people, then we have to say that the reservation system has been a success because the Indian people in the U.S. have survived because they have a reservation that they own, regardless of whether we make arguments about the imposition of the BIA and the trust and whatever other federal or government institutions are placed upon its management. The fact is that because the Indians or specific tribes in the United States own land and have a land base, they have survived as a unique people. If we use other measures of success, such as the former Secretary James Watt did, then we can say they're a failure. Now let's go back to our villages again. And more, I think we're seeing a feeling or a perceptible shift in the expectations of ANCSA. And that shift is toward expectation, or maybe it's a hope, that the ANCSA corporations and the ownership of the land really is what we're going to need if we're going to remain a unique and survive as a people. So, look, we're here a couple times. And back to the regional corporations, we see in several regional corporations now a move toward involvement of the villages in the decision-making process of the region. For example, Atna just recently merged with its villages, and control of that region is based now in the representatives from villages. My particular region just went through a reorganization where we have given back control, literally, of the regional corporation to the village corporations, where the villages now have more than a majority, a supermajority on the board, so that the village interests, and through the village representation, perhaps a closer response or responsibility to the individual stockholders that live out there, that they can affect the regional corporation in a more dramatic and direct way. And we see this in right now in the regional corporations that developing responsiveness to the needs of our village people. And when we go back to the premise that if our village people are our strength, I think we're seeing that the regional corporations are in fact strengthening themselves through this process. Now, another statement was made, I don't remember who made it, about the fact that these are profit corporations. Byron has emphasized that we're not necessarily social institutions. You know, that the fact is that it's true. However, the response of the regional corporations, the profit corporations I'm talking about, to addressing some of these other needs is not always done by choice. We are expected by our people because, in fact, there is a gap or a void that otherwise that should be filled by other institutions that we are expected as representatives of our people to address some of these needs. So we are responsive. And I think the moves that you see with the regional corporations to include villages, the fact that there is constant change in the management or the representation in the regional corporations indicates that, in fact, the stockholders do exercise a lot of their responsibility in making the regional corporations represent what they feel their needs are. I mean, this is not to say that the corporations are the answer to the needs that we have as Native people. And I've said it, and you've all said it, particularly those of you that have been leaders in the Native community, the corporation is, and ANCSA is not a perfect vehicle, and it never will be. And I think what we're trying to do is, in the face of all that's wrong with it, trying to make and do the best we can with what we've got. I don't think that a reversion to an IRA or whatever would solve the problems that we are bringing out. It's not a solution. I think really it's a set of another series or institution with its own unique and otherwise almost insolvable problems that we have with the corporate structure that we're now in. So I'm not indicting or saying that we shouldn't go back to the IRAs. I'm only saying that the problems that we're bringing out with the corporations are also true of the IRAs. Whether or not there is advantages to that structure, or maybe I should say more advantages or less disadvantages, really is an argument that I don't think can be won on either side. So if we look back again at where we are, I think that the issue of land ownership is really what is going to determine, and with the issue of land ownership, the survival of Alaska Natives as unique and different people is going to determine whether or not ANCSA can be viewed as a success. Because we, I think, do not want to be part or just another citizen. You know, we want to be Alaska Natives, we want to be Inupiaq, we want to be Aleut or Tlingit. We don't want to be just a citizen of the United States. And we heard from Mr. Jones that part of the process or part of the thinking at that time was that we, in fact, should be eventually just citizens. And I don't think we want that as Alaska Native people.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think Mr. Johnson indicated the something that lies beneath all this discussion, that lies at the root of it, and perhaps our guests might like to comment on it. Mr. Martin, I think I hope the members of the panel agree that we might proceed in this fashion for a little while and hear from Mr. Martin and Mr. Jones and Mr. Hickok and Mr. Van Ness, and then perhaps have a little more interchange. But there's been a kind of a mixed verdict on ANCSA, and you gentlemen, as not authors, but people who had something to do with Perhaps you were midwives, I don't know, but anyway, go ahead, please, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, and I direct this comment to myself as much as to others, brevity may be the soul of wit, but it is apparently not the soul of discussion of ANCSA. And at the risk of violating both your directive and the practice, I'm not going to choose to respond by speech at this point. I clearly fall on the side of the people who believe that, first, for all its flaws, ANCSA has basically held up fairly well, particularly given the fact that it has been an act which has been willingly changed by Congress when good cause has been shown. And I think that an analysis of the several amendments of ANCSA will disclose that while some have fallen into the category of special interest legislation to address the specific needs of individual corporations, and I don't mean that pejoratively, most of the major amendments have been those which dealt with institutional problems in the Act, which deserved serious attention and got it and got remedies, including, I think, the best example is something like the land bank. In the future, obviously, there are amendments like that which seem certainly in store, addressing the taxation issue, addressing the alienability issue, without knowing how they'll come out, addressing the submerged lands issue and a number of others that are being pursued either currently or prepared for later pursuit. So it seems to me clearly that the identification of flaws is a good and an ongoing process, but there's little doubt that the basic framework of the Act has held up fairly well. Going just a little bit further, it seems to me that the kinds of concerns that seem to be provoking most of the discussion on our table today, which are those which apparently go to the organizational inequity and maybe the sort of social slash cultural insensitivity of the Act, are ones which, at least I have found, have been rather abstract in terms of the advocacy. In other words, while I understand the concern, I register it, I still have not heard the specific proposals for change that are inherent in moving toward an IRA structure. And perhaps even a little bit stronger, I have real reservations, in spite of the fact they ought to be discussed thoroughly, whether those kinds of changes are realistically to be expected in the context of the amendments that we've seen to ANCSA so far. I have more to say about that, but rather than violate my own idea about not responding by speech, let me just put a question on the table that I would address to any of the individuals who either have deep concerns about the way the Act's working now or who propose fundamental structural change in the organization or implementation of the Act. And that question is, what are the specific and highest priority changes that you want to accomplish by movement in the organizational structure? The specific and highest priority changes that you want to accomplish by changes in the organizational structure.
Mr. Hickok, would you like to follow?
All right. Thank you, Judge. I have only a few comments, and I think we've heard enough of what has happened to the Act, who wrote what, who did this or that. And I'd like only my comments to be briefly directed to some future aspects for this commission and for the Native community as a whole. First, I think you really have got to define sovereignty. Whether or not you agree with me that the United States is sovereign, above the states, Judge, and also above the Indian people, is immaterial. I happen to know that the states of the United States cannot enter into treaties with foreign governments. I know that U.S. law prevails over Indian reservations. So my point is that there may be limited or diminished sovereignty. It may be inherent or otherwise, but you folks have got to define what you mean by sovereignty in the context of what you want to do. Charlie Johnson says it means freedom to him. Fine. Whatever it means, define it. I said the other day, and I repeat it, that there is nothing in the ANSCA statute itself to prevent existing corporations from going to IRAs or to any other institution. It seems to me that this is a persuasive task of persuasion internally in the Native corporations and Native communities, and I agree from my own research, having talked with several congressmen in the past several months, that it's going to be a very, very difficult task to get anything except some perfecting amendments before the Congress. I think, Byron, that you could put your land, Sea Alaska, in its own institution and separate. If you wanted to divest of the money, you could still retain the land. I think the flexibility is there to do what you need to do. There are forces of change upon this land of great magnitude. Alaska is the most rapidly growing state in the nation. The resource and economic pressures that are coming here through particularly domestic demands, but also international demands, are incredible. There are U.S. international boundary situations here in Alaska where, on the one hand, there may be cooperation and interchange, but on the other hand, we may be faced with conflict. I happen to be one of those who's written for over 10 years now on what I think is the coming conflict between the Soviet Union and United States and Alaska in the oil aspects along the international dateline. There are forces of change that you will not have any real way of coping with. You'll have to be a part of that milieu that the rest of us are in and try and handle it as a people. And the question of people is my last note. Fred Paul said that Alaskan natives are becoming westernized. I'd like to say to you that there have been many western whites in this state that have become somewhat nativized. Walt Parker and myself, when we were in our prime, would put ourselves up against any man in the woods or on the tundra or in a canoe. Walt won many dog sledding events. I won many things with axes and canoes. We both have hunted and trapped as well as anybody. We've probably been around this state in more pieces in the lands and on the woods and in the waters than almost anybody in the state. There is a thing in our history that the people of the world are becoming more and more homogenized, more the same. Many of you might be amazed to know that Mr. Starr's ancestors and my Celtic ancestors came from the same place in Central Asia. His people traveled east, my people traveled west from where we came. But we came from that same Central Asian steppe as far as the history of mankind is cognizant. So we are becoming homogenized. There are 16,000 Alaska Natives in Anchorage. There are also 3,000 Koreans here. In 1966, there wasn't hardly two or three. There is change, and we are, in many ways, becoming more and more one. Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it's a very good format, the one that you're following, to go around the table for at least one more round. And I don't think that panelists that we need to feel apologetic about doing that, of maybe tidying up something that was either said needs clarification from yesterday, or picking up on some point that another panelist responded to. And it isn't so much, I don't think, that the record be this or that, but rather that we understand each other, that we communicate well with each other, and what it was you had in mind when you said it. So if I make just a couple of points that have come up. Mr. Hope, I wanted to make sure that he, if I didn't communicate it well, on the point of shares perhaps passing into non-native hands, and my phrase that's what we wanted to happen or what we intended, be aware that the point there was that we wanted the possibility of that not to be precluded. It wasn't, I didn't mean to say, if I did, that I or anyone else was terribly anxious to see that happen. The point is that we didn't want to put unusual restrictions on it. We didn't want to, I don't think, attach constraints on it. We wanted to treat it neutrally, just like other shareholders are treated in the sense of being able to alienate it as they will. The only thing that we did attach to it was a time period in which it couldn't happen, which was, without being trying to be parental about it, I think was had to do with hoping there'd be a learning period there so that the risks of alienation later on would be minimized. So it was really, what I was talking about, Mr. Hope, was a push toward equal treatment, neutral treatment, if you will. And if that's the if that's a proposition you'd come with, neutral treatment, equal treatment, then you come to an answer like that, rather than that there was anyone was anxious to have it go into, quote, non-native hands. You didn't want to have a racial restriction, as I recall the matter, with respect to alienation. Now, a lot of our discussion has to do, I think, with two levels of talking about these things, and I suspect the first one is a tactical view of how do you achieve changes, let's say, in the Act or whatever the Act prescribed, how do you make it work out terribly well? And that's a very, very important thing, obviously. But that tactical view of it, talking about windows of opportunity to change it for the better and so on, is fine, okay, probably, as I say, more